So good evening, everyone, near and far, here at the Wall Street Zendo, and out there in all your different locations. Just gonna look at page 2 so I can see. Oh, sorry. I'm used to mine at home. Just tried to touch screen. That's okay. I trust they're out there. Great, thank you. Well, this is the fourth evening of our week-long unusual sesshin. For those who are new, sesshin means it is an intensive Zen meditation retreat, but it means to touch the heart-mind. Shin is heart, both heart and mind in Chinese and Japanese. And so it's to become really deeply acquainted with one's own heart and mind by staying put and paying attention. And body, we'll include body even though, but because the heart is really at the center of our body as well. Heart, mind, and body, paying attention to our moment-to-moment experience. And if we were doing this as a residential sesshin, which we would have been ordinarily, we would do that 24/7, round the clock. You know, even as we go into sleep, kind of to notice, you know, and then we first wake up, paying attention. So this is different. You know, we're touching in and sitting together in the morning and then again in the evening. And we're really encouraging everybody to keep that sesshin mind, that mind of paying attention and quiet, slowing down a bit throughout the day as best you can, given your life circumstances and your home circumstances. And our theme, as I think most of you know, is tending home ground. Ordinarily, we call this sesshin Mountains and Waters Sesshin, after a Zen text by Dogen, who founded Soto Zen in Japan. And since we're not up in the mountains this time, we're mostly close to home, we're calling it Tending Home Ground, with a focus on the Dharma of the Garden. So, as you know, Michael and I have been taking turns, and Monday night I talked about the Dharma of soil, and last night Michael talked about the Dharma of seeds. That sounds like we're going in order, but really not. So tonight we're going to take a little side path into the Zen garden and the mind of the Zen gardener. The renowned contemporary Japanese garden designer and Soto Zen priest Shumyo Masuno writes this: "A garden is a place where I receive guests, and also an expression of myself, the accumulation of years of Zen practice. There's an old Zen saying, the water a cow drinks becomes milk, the water a snake drinks becomes poison. The water becomes milk or poison depending on what animal drinks it. It's the same with the garden. So it's essential to practice continuously for a long time in order to produce the best quality milk." Or a garden that nurtures rather than contaminates. And so, you know, that carries, that metaphor or analogy carries far beyond simply gardening, but tending, you know, every aspect of our lives, tending community, tending the world. And that's the sense that we are exploring the theme this week as well. He continues, "If I, as the creator of the garden, do not have a settled heart-mind, I cannot create a spiritually elevated garden. A garden is a mirror that reflects myself because the garden is me." So whatever the medium or media, the medium is that we, with which we express our lives. It might be words or images, action, teaching, craft, cooking, service, tending children or tending a garden. How we cultivate our body and mind will be expressed and conveyed through that medium or those mediums. I think you are probably all familiar with the kind of classic image of a Zen garden. An expanse of white sand or gravel raked into wave-like patterns with a few carefully placed mossy, craggy stones. That's a familiar image, right? Maybe you've even played with one of those little Zen garden kits. Have you seen them? With a little tray about this big, and there's some white sand, and a little toy rake, and you can make patterns, and then there's some little stones you can arrange. It's supposed to soothe your troubled mind. I've always been a little skeptical about them. I think we have to go a bit deeper. But this form is unique in the world history of gardens. I don't think there's anything quite like it. That form of Zen garden is called Kare Sansui, which means dry mountains and waters. So I thought it's fitting that this is mountains and waters sesshin that we should look at these gardens. The word Sansui, or it goes back to the Chinese, shan shui, something like that, which consists of two characters, mountain and water. And in Chinese, it came to mean landscape. It came to refer to also those landscape paintings. You've probably seen them with the clouds draped over craggy, steep mountains. And then a little hermit or a little monk on pilgrimage going along a stream, or in the little hut maybe amongst the mountains. Beautiful paintings.
Excuse to interrupt. It sounds like a lot of people can't hear you, Kate.
Oh, really? Why might that be? I'm consulting our tech aide, River. Can we
Let me just get the external mic just in case.
We're going to pause and get the external mic. Raise your hand if you're having trouble hearing me. Okay. Is my voice just too faint? Okay, we're going to get another mic. Pause. So, the meaning of Sansui, mountains and waters, as landscape, is different from what we think of as landscape in Western culture. David Hinton is a translator of ancient Chinese poetry, and this is his book called Mountain Home, The Wilderness Poetry of Ancient China. And he talks about this difference. He says, in terms of poetry, but we can carry it into the garden as well. He says, fundamentally different from writing that employs the natural world as a stage or materials for human concerns, this poetry articulates a profound and spiritual sense of belonging to a wilderness of truly awesome dimensions. This is not wilderness in the superficial sense of nature or landscape, terms the Western cultural lens has generally applied to this most fundamental aspect of Chinese poetry. Nature, this is in quotes, nature calls up a false dichotomy between human and nature, and landscape, in quotes, suggests a picturesque realm seen from a spectator's distance. But the Chinese wilderness is nothing less than a dynamic cosmology in which humans participate in the most fundamental way. The poetry of this wilderness cosmology feels utterly contemporary. I mean, these paintings, you know, go back hundreds and hundreds of years, 10th century or so. But they feel that, but the worldview feels utterly contemporary, and in an age of global ecological disruption and mass extinction, this engagement with wilderness makes it more urgently and universally important by the day. So rereading this several years ago at this same session, we focused on the poetry of mountains and waters. Rereading this, I asked myself if looking at the Zen garden through this different lens would help us to see it other than something sort of cliched and quaint, sort of like a postcard view. First, it's worth noting that mountains and waters have been associated with powerful archetypal qualities in many earth-based spiritual traditions around the world. Mountains with height, transcendence, solidity, brightness, and then water with fluidity, transformation, nourishment. We could see them as yang and yin, as the Chinese did, male and female, qualities that we all have within us because we are made of earth, water, fire, and air. In Japanese folk Buddhism, mountains are associated with images of a fierce protective deity called Fudo Myo. Fudo means unmoving, and Myo means bright king, referring to his bright wisdom. He's a fierce-looking figure, more like the deities in Tibetan Buddhism. He has one squinty blind eye, and he has two fangs, one pointing upward and one pointing down. And he scowls. And he carries a sword to cut through delusion and a rope to restrain our unwholesome, impulsive action, habitual actions. And he's often depicted standing in a ring of flames, or seated on a craggy rock. And his unmoving quality is not a rigid immobility, it's rather a kind of dynamic stillness, poised, ready to move at any moment in any direction, responding to circumstances. Unhindered by the push and pull of all our wants and dislikes. So Fudo is particularly revered in Japan, in the Japanese tradition, by mountain ascetics called Yamabushi, who would go on long pilgrimages in the mountains and do ascetic practices, such as something called Mizugyo, which means water practice, which involves standing under a cold waterfall, wearing only a loincloth, and chanting the Heart Sutra really, really, really hard to generate ki or chi. And it's a purifying practice. It generates both ki and also camaraderie amongst the fellow practitioners who survive it. This past spring, Michael and I discovered a beautiful little waterfall and pool hidden away on Blue Mountain, where we live, hitherto unknown to us. And we thought we could have a pandemic purification Mizugyo here. Anyone interested? Yeah? Okay. We'll do it. Learn your Heart Sutra by heart. Okay. Now, a contrasting and complementary image which is often associated with water, is Guanyin or Kannon, the Bodhisattva of compassion, who in Chinese and Japanese Buddhism is depicted as female. And she often stands on a rock amid ocean waves or rides in a small boat. Gary Snyder, the great American Zen poet, wrote a wonderful essay on Dogen's Mountains and Water Sutra. And he says these two, Fudo and Kannon, are Buddha work partners. Ascetic discipline and relentless spirituality balanced by compassionate tolerance and forgiveness. Wisdom and compassion, the two wings of our practice. Those images are not familiar to most of us in our culture, Fudo and Kannon. But when Michael and I lived in Japan, we came to see and feel how deeply meaningful and beloved they are in traditional Japanese culture. And to some extent, they still are. You see these images all over, all over. I wonder if in time we'll create images that meld those archetypes with the materials, the red cedar, and the energies of this land in gardens that harmonize with these ecosystems. Maybe you will feel the presence of Fudo and Kannon within you as you practice in these coming days, in the gardens, in the forests, by the waters. This mountains and waters diet is not only metaphorical, it also is literally depicting the water cycle, right? Particularly here on the West Coast, how the water comes in, evaporates, but comes in, hits the mountains, rains, usually rains, washes down, rushes down into the sea, and evaporates up into the sky again. If you look at the old Chinese scroll paintings of craggy mountains and rushing waterfalls, you'll see the ancient origins of the Kare Sansui gardens, the dry mountains and waters gardens. You see how the swirling white combed sands look like the cloud draped peaks in the ancient scroll paintings. But this aesthetic of mountains and waters also has roots in the indigenous Japanese reverence for natural forms in Shinto. Shinto is the earth-based spirituality that predated contact with China in Japan and only became more of an organized religion in more modern times, closer to modern times. And it coexisted. These practices, these indigenous practices, coexisted with Buddhism for hundreds of years. In Shinto, which means the way of the gods, myriad kami. Kami is often translated as gods, but I think spirits is a little better word. Kami reside everywhere in the natural world, in stones, in ancient trees, in waterfalls, and mountains. All are venerated. Each little village has its own kami, protective kami, and a little shrine. There are little shrines all over Japan, and small, very small and very large shrines, Shinto shrines, everywhere. And the classic, you've seen the pictures of the classic gate marking entrance to a Shinto shrine is the torii, the two uprights and then the two curved horizontals across the top. Are people still hearing me? I'll try and keep projecting. And there's a wonderful, so you'll see big stones or trees, big, venerable, hundreds of years old trees with a twisted straw rope around them and then zigzag paper streamers that mark them as a kami, as sacred. And there's a rich tradition of folklore of stories that recount local tales of mysterious occurrences passed down in the oral tradition about this rock or this tree, for example. Something strange and wondrous that happened. So in these gardens, there may be visual illusions, just as, you know, there are, you know, illusions in writing and poetry. There are visual illusions that to places or characters or stories that are lost not only to us, but most modern Japanese. The contemporary Zen garden designer Shumyo Masuno, who I mentioned at the beginning, describes how when he begins to work with a garden, he actually enters into kind of dialogue with the stones, the trees, and the water. The spirit. He calls it the kokoro, which is the character for the Japanese pronunciation of shin, which is heart-mind. So the kokoro, the heart-mind of the stone, or the tree, or the stream. He actually engages. He listens to them, or he asks them. So gardens in Japan predated Zen, and they even predated Buddhism. In the Heian period, the 11th century, we know that gardens were an important part of the culture of the court nobility. And they typically incorporated stones and ponds and streams and natural vegetation designed to sort of distill and express the natural beauty of the Japanese landscape. There's a very early text from the 11th century called the Sakuteiki, the Record of Garden Making, and it advises, visualize the famous landscapes of our country and come to understand their most interesting points. Recreate the essence of those scenes in the garden, but do so interpretatively, not strictly. So it's a kind of, distillation is kind of a good word, I think, these gardens. And they served both to provide views from inside the residence, but also for elegant entertainments like poetry competitions in the garden. Buddhism in Japan at that time was mainly concerned with prayers and rituals. Protection against disease, that sort of thing. And it didn't have any special influence on gardens until a little later, maybe more into the 12th century, as Pure Land Buddhism was introduced. In Pure Land Buddhism, places a Buddha called Amida Buddha, sort of an archetypal Buddha, at the center of a faith-based practice of chanting the name of Amida, Namu Amida Butsu, Namu Amida Butsu, in the hope that one will be reborn in the Pure Land, which is a kind of paradise-like place from which it's much easier to achieve nirvana than here in this human world. So Pure Land gardens were more formal and symmetrical and ostentatious. They're depicting a kind of view of paradise with more exotic plants imported from China and elaborate waterways. And the stone arrangements in these gardens often represented trinities of Buddhist figures. So Amida, Buddha would be in the middle, and Kannon, the Bodhisattva of compassion, on one side, and then Seishi Bodhisattva, which is a not very common Bodhisattva. Michael, do you remember who Seishi is? Putting him on the spot. Mm-hmm. No? Okay, that's right. And or else Fudo, who I already mentioned, with two attendants. So often these Buddhist trinities would be represented in rocks. And they would be arranged according to feng shui, or in Japanese, fusui, principles. For example, it's very unlucky to place a triad of Buddhas facing a residence. They must be slightly angled, or you really get in trouble. So Buddhist monks were known to have been involved in garden construction from early on. And they were known, but they often sort of low-ranking, laboring monks. They were called Ishitate-so, stone-setting monks. And stone-setting came to refer to the art of garden design, the art of stone-setting. Now, the Zen tradition didn't reach Japan from China until the early 13th century. And it was Rinzai Zen that first became established in Kyoto amongst the aristocratic class, with the five great early monasteries founded there. So the father of the Zen garden, as we know it, or as we think of it now, was a monk who was also famed as a teacher named Musō Sōseki. He was born in 1275, so that's a generation after Dogen's death. And he practiced for some time at Kenninji, the earliest Rinzai temple where Dogen also practiced before he went to Japan. Before he went to China. It's not known how Musō came to be a garden designer, but he would have been very well acquainted with his earlier traditions. He'd probably read the Sakuteki. We do know that he was already in his 60s when he was asked by the new shogun to design a garden for the restoration of a 600-year-old temple called Saihoji that had been destroyed in decades of civil war. This shogun was tormented by his role in the terrible suffering and destruction of that war. And he retired to take up Buddhist practice only two years after entering the shogunate. He passed it on to his brother. And this garden at Saihoji is reminiscent of the Pure Land Paradise Gardens, with a path around a pond, but more irregular, more naturalistic. But there's an upper garden where the first known Zen Kare Sansui, dry mountains and waters garden, can be seen, and it's kind of wild and rocky, like a rock and gravel waterfall. Today, this famous garden can be visited only with advance reservation, and it's known by its nickname, Kokedera, which means moss temple. But the famous moss did not appear until the late 19th century, when the temple was so short of funds that they couldn't take care of it, and the moss invaded, and now it's famous as the Moss Temple. It originally would have been white sand, sort of white sand or gravel. The American poet W.S. Merwin translated Musō's poetry, and in his introduction, he says, "One of the conditions." One of the materials, indeed, of the art of gardening, whatever gardeners may think of it, is the role of change, which makes gardening particularly appropriate to Buddhism. Nothing stays as the hand of the gardener leaves it, or as the mind of the gardener originally conceives of it. Anyone who gardens knows that. And although Musō, in his gardens, made extensive and original use of such things as rocks, which change so slowly that they can be taken as symbols of permanence, those gardens of his which later generations saw and see are inevitably different from those he would have seen in his lifetime. Trees and all living things there have grown, died, and been replaced. Shadows and leaves fall differently, even in those gardens that have been cared for and kept as close as possible to the way he designed them. So, of course, he's talking about impermanence, or mujo in Japanese, which is, of course, a core Buddhist understanding. and central to the aesthetic expressed in the Zen arts of tea ceremony, calligraphy, ikebana, poetry. Very different from Western aesthetics. Probably the most famous Kari Sansui garden in Japan is called Ryoanji. Has anyone here seen it? Maybe not. Some of you who went on our trips to Japan, yeah, some of you have seen it. It's a simple rectangle covered in raked white sand, gravel. It's really gravel. Surrounded by a low wall on three sides. The fourth side is the temple building from which you can sit on the veranda and look at the garden, which is a spare yet subtle arrangement of 15 stones in groups of 5, 2, 3, 2, and 3. No vegetation, no water, no representational images. It's a very stripped-down garden. It was probably created in the very early 16th century, but almost nothing is known about its creator or creators. Why would someone create such a garden? We might as well ask why someone would create an abstract painting or a stripped-down poem that leaves us just a few stark images, but somehow brings us to a standstill, an open space of unknowing. A little later in the history of Japanese gardens comes the tea garden, the wabi-cha garden, which is, with its simple, natural serenity, designed to invite tea ceremony guests to become present with ease, to open their senses to the experience of each moment. Whole books have been written about the tea aesthetic and these hard-to-translate values, wabi. Wabi, you might say, is quiet, the quiet, rustic simplicity of a poet's rundown hut. And sabi, the beauty of an old, worn, cracked tea bowl. And yugen, the subtle, profound grace of an aged and old no-actor's dance. These are all part of experiencing a Zen garden, I think. Zen gardens continue to be made today. And Shumyo Masuno, there's this lovely book that has pictures. You can take a peek afterwards if you'd like of Shumyo Masuno's gardens. And there's an interview with him in this book where he talks about how important his Zen training was or is to his work. He says, first of all, feeling gratitude for being able to design, then not being attached to the desire to make something myself. Beginning to listen to the earth and the unique qualities in nature, and thoroughly considering the state of mind of the people who will use the place, the design will flow forth spontaneously. In the act of carefully carrying out these tasks one by one, Zen training truly has a strong effect on my attitude towards design. Without Zen training, my current design would be impossible. Then he also talks about how he wants people to experience his gardens. He says, depending on how people encounter the gardens, I want them to see the garden as a place for observing themselves intently. Even more than the beauty of the garden, not comprehending the garden that extends in front of one's eyes as an objective target, but just considering it as part of oneself. I want people to view the garden they are gazing on and their own selves as one. Things are as they seem. The rocks in a garden, also the trees, water, everything is there as itself. In Zen, this is termed Hotoke no So. The Buddha itself. The Buddha just as it is. This way of seeing is not at all different for Japanese or non-Japanese. I really appreciated him saying that, because sometimes when living in Japan, I encountered an attitude that it was sort of like, oh, you Westerners can't understand this. You know, you can't understand this Japanese aesthetics or experience. So I'm glad that we are included in, and he's, I understand that he's made design gardens all over the world. So he really is inviting everyone to experience themselves in the garden. Oh dear, this has taken too long, and I hope that it hasn't been too historical and theoretical. I was tempted to take advantage of Zoom technology and show you some examples, but the screen is still too distanced, and I thought this isn't a travelogue, it's a Dharma talk. So, if you need to leave, please do, but if you have a few more minutes, I'd like to share with you a little bit of my own experience of the Zen garden. If you go to some of these famous Zen gardens that I've talked about, unless you get there very, very early before the tour buses arrive, or you're lucky to have a special connection, you're likely to be overrun by junior high school students, or these days by Chinese tourists. There are a lot these days, and they're being lectured too loudly by their tour guide. And if you go to Kokedera, the mosque temple, you'll be herded around in a group, and so you have to kind of pull back and straggle in the rear to have, you know, so you have a chance to be a little bit quiet in the garden. But we found, living in Kyoto, one of the joys, living there year-round, one of the joys is being able to visit some of these famous places off-season when the tourists were gone. But even greater was the delight of discovering a hidden gem of a garden off the beaten path. And one of these was just a short walk from where we lived in southeast Kyoto, and we often stopped by. So I just invite you to come on a walk with me down the narrow street that leads from Fushimi Inari Taisha, which is an ancient, very, very old, large Shinto complex of Shinto shrines that it covers an entire hillside. And we lived right next door. And there's a short walk to Tofukuji, which is the second oldest Zen temple in Japan. But on the way, we come to a modest gate leading to a small side temple. A path of flat stones leads to the main hall. We rinse our hands at a stone basin along the path. There's no one at the entrance, no one taking tickets or handing out pamphlets. We take off our shoes and place them on a shelf and step inside. Let's imagine it's a warm day in May, so the straw tatami mats feel cool on our bare feet. We walk through a large room open to the expanse of the gardens, and we sit on a wide wooden engawa, sort of a veranda. The garden is an irregular expanse of raked white gravel, the size of a pond, but with the scale of a lake, dotted with craggy moss-covered stones. The eye naturally travels from one group of stones to the other, taking in the shapes and the textures, and then shifting out to the longer view. The cherry trees in the southeast corner are past blooming, but the garden is surrounded by densely planted azalea bushes, some in bright pink bloom, some just budding out. And higher up, the intense, delicate early green of the Japanese maples. A bird sings a light melody over and over again. Hokkekyo, 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 Lotus Sutra. It's a plain little bush warbler singing out the name of the Lotus Sutra. A gentle breeze keeps us from overheating. We stretch out our legs and breathe deeply as the preoccupations and worries drain out of our minds like sand through an hourglass. If we come again in August, the moss will be rusty and parched. The heat will be so intense we retreat into the hall and stretch out on the tatami. No one's looking. And we listen to the pulsing calls of the cicadas. Wee, 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 wee. And we understand Basho's haiku. Shizuke saya iwa ni shimi iru semi no koe. Stillness. The cicadas' voices pierce the stones. If we come back in late October, we almost gasp as the garden comes into view. The stones and the raked white gravel waves are still there. But the colors of the Japanese maples, scarlet, gold, and flame, seem to be dancing around the stillness. The air is bright and clear, and we feel energized, though we know the leaves will soon fall to the ground. We don't mind if a few other people find their way here and sit quietly taking refuge from the crowds viewing the famous foliage at nearby Tofukuji. And if we come back in mid-January, once the New Year's festivities have gone by, we might not stay long in the unheated temple, but the light snow frosting the old gray stones and patterning the gravel sweeps away all thought. We're not quite sure who or where we are. There's just this movement of snowflakes falling in the stillness. Each of us will have different memories or images and reflections arise as we visit the garden. They're part of the changing landscape of mountains and waters through the seasons. Sometimes we have Zen garden moments in our daily lives. We find a small Zen garden in an unexpected place, completely disguised as something ordinary. Last October, Michael and I took a hike. We live an hour east of here. We took a hike along an old logging road on a mountainside, not far from our place. It was a chilly, clear morning, but I was unsettled. I was fretting over a Zoom meeting that hadn't gone well. Have you ever done that? And I was tired and sad, as this was the time approaching when I would have, a year prior, gone back east to visit my mom for her birthday. And her death, just last spring, at age 96, of COVID, still felt distant and unreal because I couldn't go. We came to a lookout over the Fraser River with a brilliant view of Mount Baker, snowy Mount Baker, silhouetted in the morning light, but still my mind did not clear. And as we trudged back, I happened to look down and I saw the sun glittering on the frosty, filigreed leaves of the big leaf maples. You know those big, big maple leaves? And they were caramel colored because they had fallen this year before they had a chance to turn gold. And I was brought up short, seeing their beauty, as though through my own and my mother's eyes at once. Held in this great stillness, my mom loved fall leaves and dried seed pods and grasses. And so I walked on and I picked dried goldenrod and pearly everlastings and dried grasses and made a bouquet for the dying season. So I'm going to close. Sorry this is so late, but it's so hard to talk about these things when there's so much to share. This is a poem by Musō Soseki, It's called Poem on Dry Mountain. A high mountain soars without a grain of dust. A waterfall plunges without a drop of water. Once or twice on an evening of moonlight in the wind, this man here has been happy, playing the game that suited him. And when I read this, I thought, yeah, once in a while, on a moonlit night, a light breeze moving in the trees, right here where I am, is a Zen garden. And I am simply happy, even in deep sadness. This is possible. So, your homework, once again, is to keep your eyes open for a hidden Zen garden, disguised as something ordinary in your daily life, and allow it to bring you to a stop and just receive it. And then when you get home, you might want to write a haiku. Okay, thank you so much. We've run over time. Let's skip the Dharma talk chant, because I don't like us to go late. Let's go, let's put our seats back, and we'll chant the refuges together to close. Okay? That's what we'll do.